Hi, this is Justin Landon with Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. Yesterday, we posted a show with myself, Tor.com czar Irene Gallo, Tor.com editorial assistant Carl Engel Laird, and Hugo-nominated blogger Liz Burke. The show, if I do say so myself, is a strong 90-minute overview of what's going on with this year's ballot. For the faint of heart, I'll just quickly mention that Tor.com has five pieces of short fiction on the ballot, and Tor.com editors Liz Gorinsky and Ellen Datlow also appear. The aforementioned Liz Burke is on the ballot for fan writer, and regular Tor.com contributors Jared Shuren and me are nominated in Best Related Work for our book, Speculative Fiction 2012, the best online reviews, essays, and commentary. I'll take this moment of privilege to offer my sincere congratulations to all the folks at Tor.com for their great years, and all the rest of the nominees except those in Best Related Work, scalawags, all of them. In the meantime, welcome Joe Monti, executive editor of Simon & Schuster's new science fiction and fantasy imprint, Saga Press.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, we're excited to have you, Joe, and frankly, we're more excited about Saga Press. You know, just before we get started, I kind of want to ask, what's the deal with executive editor? We hear a lot of different terms that are thrown out there. I remember hearing Patrick Nielsen Hayden having a commentary with, I think, Beth Meacham on a blog post that I saw out there that were discussing what editor titles mean. So what exactly is an executive editor?
At Tor, it's a different thing. knowing Patrick well. But here, there's executive editor, there's senior editor, there's editorial director. But my titles commensurate with the experience level I've had within the editorial side of things in publishing. And I'm in charge of the imprint of Saga Press.
So how does that compare to, like, say, editor-in-chief, which you see thrown out there every once in a while?
Well, I report to my boss, Justin Chanda, who's publisher. Editor-in-chief is usually kind of like the right hand to the publisher. Some publishing houses have that, some don't. So depends on the house. Simon & Schuster really doesn't, at least on the kids' side, where I am part of the group of. I could say that again in English. They have associate publishers instead.
Okay, so, you know, I ask that because you always sort of wonder, you know, who's making the final call on a manuscript at a press. So it sounds like that's you with some buy-in from your publisher.
Right. It's a small, tight-knit group, which is nice. And the president of Simon & Schuster Jones Division, John Anderson's part of it as well.
Oh, so it sounds like you've got that ever-important corporate buy-in.
Yeah, no, it's been great from the beginning. The sales team's behind it. Everyone seems to be behind it. And it's an interesting spot because I'm doing adult fantasy and science fiction and horror, but it's housed within the children's division. And so I'm a little bit like Vatican City inside of Rome. It's been a fun experience, and we're still working through some of the behind-the-scenes stuff of, like, sales and marketing and whatnot. But for the part that the readership's going to see, what you're going to see is an integration of what best practices are working on the children's and YA side and on the adult side, and merging both of those together, and along with the editorial vision that we have for the press.
That's fantastic. Obviously, YA has been doing a lot of cool things lately, and it seems like the sales numbers have really backed that up. There probably are a lot of lessons to learn from that. So let me ask you this question that's kind of been lurking in the back of my mind for quite a while as I've looked at the various across the science fiction and fantasy field. And one of those is that Simon & Schuster really hasn't owned their own SFF or speculative line as far back as I can remember. And so I guess my biggest question to you is, what the heck took so long?
There's a history there. It started 81, 82, I believe. I could be wrong on that date, with David Hartwell and John Douglas and Timescape. That lasted a little while, and after that split up, David and John found other homes 30-odd years ago. And then there was Pocket's always had Pocket, which is now Gallery Books, has always done an element of fantasy and science fiction, from Douglas Adams to other things. But Bain came along, Jim Bain, with Bain Books, and that was primarily their concern. And so although Bain is separately owned and Simon & Schuster is a distributor, that was the focus for a long time. And honestly, it just John Anderson had the idea of doing this imprint, and worked for about a year and a half to get everyone on board. And everyone realized that post 2009, 2008, as things started to change with the rise of ebooks and the economy failing a bit, what's worked is genre, fantasy, science fiction, mystery, romance, on the adult side. And of course, children's and YA, continue to grow as well. And so they looked at this as an investment of, growing, even further. And they were just kind of leaving money on the table. That's how we kind of grew out of this.
So Bane will continue to be distributed by Simon & Schuster, and that sort of gives them the kind of relationship that Daw has with Penguin?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Cool.
Okay, so I'm sure the big question out there that everybody is interested in knowing, and I know I'm certainly interested in knowing, you know, I certainly like to characterize presses by editorial direction. I mean, I think you can look at what Orbit Books is doing today, and you can see a Davy Pillai novel. Like, you sort of know what kind of books she's buying and what she's passionate about, and it's reflected in the press. So if I were writing and I was a reader and I'm thinking to myself, Joe Monty is now the guy behind Saga Press. So what's a Joe Monty novel?
Well, it's a little broad. I mean, you know, I have literary tastes, and I think that ends up getting skewed as quiet, as dull. It's way more about a quality level of writing. Yeah, one book I kept pointing to was Tad Williams' Dragon Bone Chair trilogy. What we want to do for the imprint, largely, not exclusively, but largely, is publish into that gateway, that spectrum of older YA, if you will, to adult. You know, and there's been a long tradition of fantasy science fiction having characters who are teens or just kind of that coming of age. Level, and by book two or three, you know, they've matured to some degree, and whether that's through age or not, like Wheel of Time only takes place a couple of years, and yet, from the beginning with Rand to the end, it's vastly different, right? But, you know, those first couple of books, it's very much coming of age. Who are these people, you know? And, there's a grand tradition of that, and I want to, exploit it because I think it's always worked, and I think, here's controversy number one, I don't believe in Grim Dark.
Oh, there we go. Joe Monty throws down the gauntlet. So Mark Lawrence need not apply?
No. I'm not talking about the quality of his writing, because it's high, and I like Mark Lawrence's book. You know, poster boy, him, Joe Abercrombie maybe is the bigger poster boy. You know, I think they succeed because they're good writers and not because there's this other movement happening. You know, there's been this overcharacterization, which happens whenever there's something big that happens in a field. So you got George, right? George R. R. Martin succeeding so well, Song of Ice and Fire. And that led to this, and I don't believe it's really what the readership is looking for, exclusively, you know, and that's what publishing's been publishing into. And so, to some degree, stepping away from that a little bit. And, you know, then there's all the other crazy stuff like women writing fantasy and science fiction.
Oh, Joe.
So one of our little mottos, the other editor that works with me is Nava Wolf. And one of our models or maxims that we're working on is misogyny free.
Well, that's fantastic. You're going to get a lot of support with that kind of mentality, I think. And I'll tell you, the Grimdark is a real rabbit hole that we could go down. Down. I have a great many thoughts about that particular subject.
Let's go.
So, you know, I write the Joe Abercrombie reread for Tor.com. You know, I'm a huge fan of his work.
That's right.
It's interesting. I actually enjoy Mark's work quite a bit. I think Mark Lawrence is a brilliant writer, and that series is one of the more important series that's been published in recent years, I believe. But I also would argue that I really think Mark Lawrence has functionally killed Grimdark. It's sort of like, where else can you take it? How much more grim can you get than a rampaging, murdering 14-year-old child? You know, as you say, exceptional writers will always stand out, of course.
Right. Well, you know, I would counter with the movement, if you will, has petered out. And we can just point at Joe and what he's doing now with his new series. And, you know, his decision to try to create something that was YA. I haven't seen it. I haven't read it.
Well, I have.
Sure, stick that in my eye. But, you know, it's the kind of thing I think that we would like to publish, you know. In the type, it's, you know, I like to equate Joe Abercrombie to kind of like Quentin Tarantino in a way. You know? There's that quality of violence and characterization that is so strong. And they kind of go hand in hand. But does that lead to a movement? You know, I think that he and George were coming out at a certain time when fantasy was in a bit of a doldrums. And, you know, what George has done is taken it from a big point of view and had this large cast of characters. And, you have a war. When you have a war, people die, but people don't expect that in their literature. And so that led to the Grimdark, but actually there's no correlation between the two.
Yeah, so do you think Grimdark is some kind of wake-up call or flag-planting moment from genre saying, hey, science fiction and fantasy can be dark, it can be serious, it can deal with, you know, the real world in some way that perhaps there was an impression that it couldn't, however wrong that impression was in the first place?
You know, I know what you mean, but no, I actually think it's... I think it's a marketing term that ended up being useful as an envelope to look at what some certain authors were doing as far as a level of realism. You know, it's just like when you look at an action movie, right? You know, you see these guys getting punched in the face and, you know, and then the body and whatnot, and these large muscled men doing this. And, you know, if you got hit in the head by almost anyone, you'd have a concussion, you'd be on the floor, you know, and the other person's hand would be broken. You know, but that's not what we see. And so we've got this hyper-realistic view of what happens. Same thing with fantasy, I think. You've got these large battles or consistent battles, and, like, no one's really hurt. You know, oh, this is a little cut here or that. You know, instead, like, people die. You know, there's if you're looking at it, I remember Sam Sykes talking about this, about his adventurers. And I think he's got a good point that you look at the adventurers and these are not really socially sane people.
Yeah, Sam does a really fantastic job with that. I mean, he's really subverting that notion.
Right, right. And, you know, so I would counter with that we've gone through a generation or two of that kind of fantasy, and we're coming out the other end of like, well, all right, I want to look at something a little more realistic. And what are characters in this situation really going to react to? And what are they going to live? And it's a cruel world. It's a cruel world. And it's got to be evident in our fantasy as well.
So using Joe Abercrombie as a test case in his new novel, Half a King, which is ostensibly being marketed as a YA, although having read it, I would probably call it something more like what I've heard new adult referred to as, you know, sort of a transitional period between young adult and adult?
Well, I would actually say new adult, no, because the coin of statement from Barry Goldblatt, who I think has phrased it properly, new adult is just reduced to bad women's fiction. Just, that's all it's been reduced to. So what was kind of an idea is...
Well, I have heard it referred to as that transitional period between adult and young adult.
Yeah, no, it never got there.
Okay.
But I know what you're trying to get at, and this is the kind of thing that, you know, we're looking to publish as well, but... you know, because I think there's a lot of power there in the storytelling. And I think, you know, one of the universal truths is that we all feel like outsiders, you know. And I think that coming-of-age story ends up relating a lot of that in the character's pathos to the reader. And so when you have those kind of stories, you know, it's essentially seen as a YA, but it's not. I mean, tonally, there are different things. Again, I haven't read it. I've heard different opinions from different people, different editors, when it was going through the acquisition process of how they thought of it. But I would agree. I mean, and furthermore, I would posit that we're moving away from the Grimdark because it's not really what people want to read.
So moving on to a different subject a bit, what do you think about some of the comments that have been made by some female fantasy authors? I'm thinking particularly of former Nightshade author Teresa Frohawk and Ace author M.L. Brennan, and certainly Cameron Hurley has written about this subject extensively at times, that as women writing darker themed novels, fantasy or science fiction, although mostly it's being used to refer to fantasy, but writing darker toned novels, that they're bringing around to editors and finding that publishers are just not as enthusiastic about publishing that kind of dark toned book from a female author. What do you think about that? Is that a thing?
Well, I would doubt it. I mean, I've only read two of the three of those, and I would say no. Yeah, I think what Cameron ends up writing is more the weird combined with dark fantasy. And, you know, I think in general, it's just a gross generalization. The misogyny point and that women are not accepted the same way for Grimdark, I don't believe that's true at all. I mean, look at Davy. Look at what Davy's acquired at Orbit. No. No. That aside, I think, in general, I think there's a tendency to go lockstep. Because it's actually a small industry, you know. There's the Big Five, and then there are a couple other people who are having smaller presses and bringing some good works. And but it's small. It's small. There aren't this plethora of imprints like you have in other genres or other categories. And so there's a tendency to think like, okay, well, this is working. This is all that could work. So I think it's more of a reaction to that than anything specific. The other way.
Well, I suppose there's always sort of that concern that, you know, you have limited marketing and sales budget, that if you're going to go out and acquire a title, you want to be reasonably sure it's going to sell.
Sure, but I think, you know, it's there isn't a large pool necessarily. And so I think you look at Tor, they do a diverse group, but most other science fiction imprints are 3, 4, 5 editors, you know, and so even something like Del Rey.
Well, and Orbit is what, 2?
And they've grown, fortunately. Yeah, but yeah, it's small. It's 4 people, you know, now I think you're acquiring.
Well, yeah, you know, it's certainly a big challenge these days. You know, editors don't just edit. I mean, they're also being asked to do quite a bit of other things as well. So now that you're an editor, we've already talked a little bit about what you want to buy and what you like. But as a former agent, you're finding yourself probably in a fairly interesting situation where some of your former clients are sending you manuscripts.
You know, it's the latter is not a problem. You know, in fact, you know, I've acquired a couple of them, so there's that. You know, it's interesting when I was meeting with other literary agents as I started, and some of them I knew better than others, but you know, get have lunch, talk things out. Yeah, I would say things like, well, you're still thinking like an agent, Joe. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? So I don't know that I've actually left it. But, you know, what's interesting to me from my own little closed view of myself, I haven't changed. It goes back to my experience as a buyer at Barnes & Noble. And I always liked looking at patterns. And I liked looking at the niche that you can exploit. Exploit's maybe not the best word, but you could that you can grow. And I still think that way as an editor. You know, I think, okay, well, what's working here? And if you have X working, then there always is something similar to that. And I think that's what Grimdark grew out of, and then became this thing that actually doesn't exist. I'm enjoying it, honestly.
Have you tried to write a contract yet that you never would have accepted as an agent?
Not yet. You know, I'm not worried about it. It's something I think we can always have a dialogue about. And so, and it's kind of a natural one because I've been there. So that said, part of why I left being an agent was because this is my dream job. I mean, it really is my dream job. And, which is also exciting and scary. But along with that, I like to tilt at windmills and pat myself on the back moment, but I've been successful at it. And so it's a lot harder to do that as an agent than as a buyer. There's a buyer and a seller. And as an agent, you're a seller. And as a buyer, as an editor, it's easier to go like, all right, you know, I'm going to give this a shot because I think this could work. Whereas an agent, like, oh, come on, give this a shot. It could work. It's a lot harder to sell because you're getting to the editor and then you got to get to the acquisitions process, the marketing and in sales and everyone to come on board. I'm enjoying this.
So as an agent, you know, I know there are different sorts of agents out there. There are ones that are very editorial inclined, ones that are, you know, more tinkerers, ones that are more just contracts and getting the manuscript sold, and then maybe relying more on the imprints editor to take up the editorial work. So given where you're sitting today, I would guess that you were more a get your elbows into the manuscript kind of agent.
Yeah, kind of guy. I like I like to, yeah. You know, there's a moment where you just kind of step away. Like, you know, it's never done. A, it's never done. But B, as an agent, to go, all right, this is good enough. Like, you get to that kind of 80 to 90%, like, it's good enough. You know, there's still some things you should tighten up, and you should leave room for somebody else to go in and fix up the way they want to or the way they see it. And now, of course, I get down to the nitty-gritty, which is fun.
Well, are you a little bit worried now that as you move into this new step that you may not have the same kind of time to work on manuscripts that maybe you had in the past just because of the faster turnaround time that you've got to buy them and get them out the door?
No. I'll have more. That's why I don't have to step away now. Now it's, yeah, break this all down. You know, it is that dialogue. It's final. It's between me and the author and what we both see is what makes the book better. But, you know, one thing that hasn't changed is that there's not my view of what your book is. It's how to make the book that you want better. You know, if you're trying to get to this theme here, how you're going to get there, that kind of thing, you know. And so I've always loved those kind of conversations.
So now in your first year, and I assume your first year will be, what, 2015?
Right, spring 15, yeah.
All right, so how many books are you expecting in that first year?
Somewhere between 10 to 12. We've got almost 10 signed up now. So still a little room to do some more. But it's, you know, the first season's going to start in February. And that's February 15.
Coming fast.
In publishing terms, it really is.
So have you started bringing in cover artists and that sort of thing yet?
Sure. Well, yeah. Yeah, we've got a couple covers already. And we're working on some other things still, you know. But yeah, in other publishing terms, I'm late. spring 15 was all due in December and I started November 4th. So, you know, but.
Wow.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all right. We're just kind of working through it and then we'll catch up.
Right. And so long term, are you looking at a list somewhere in the neighborhood of about the size of Orbit?
Initially, I think we're going to be end up mirroring Orbit in many ways, in that it's going to be around 15 titles in the beginning for a couple of years, and then we'll see where it goes.
In terms of format, what are you looking at? Mostly hardcovers, trade paperbacks? You going to do any mass markets?
It's going to be a mix. You know, like one of our titles definitely going to do hardcover, Ken Liu's debut fantasy novel. And some we're going to do debut trade paperback. Some it's kind of up in the air still. We'll get feedback from accounts and sales. But it's going to be a mix.
Well, since you brought him up, Ken Liu is obviously an author that a lot of folks have been waiting to see a novel from for a long time. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you represented him as his agent. And so this is obviously a manuscript that you have seen long before you got it on submission.
Right.
And from what I understand, this is something that you've been working on with him for a while. Had you ever put it out on submission before?
No, Ken and I were talking about it, and he felt it wasn't ready yet. And so we had that discussion, and then it's an interesting turn of events because just when we were getting to the point where he felt comfortable with it is when this opportunity came up at Simon Schuster. And again, it was my dream job, and it was that kind of almost. And so, you know, I helped the transition, and found a new agent, and then I jumped on that.
Well, it's certainly got to give him some measure of comfort that you'll be continuing to work on the project.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, bonded us early on was that I totally got what he was doing with this. And obviously that hasn't changed. And so we've kind of been lockstep in that regard, which has been important. You know, it's an epic fantasy, and the idea is that you think it's Chinese fantasy, and it's not. You know, he's taking elements of that and Journey to the West and other tales and kind of reconfiguring it into a Western fantasy mold. And I think it's really exciting.
Although it's clearly not the terms you're actually using here, but I hear the term Western and I hear something connected to Asian themes, and I'm immediately jumping to, you know, something like Kurosawa, which is clearly not what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's in my head, it's more akin to like the Iliad. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's Romance of the Three Kingdoms, if you're familiar with that. You know, if you're not, John Woo did Red Cliff. There's also the Jet Li movie, Hero. Those are some of the kind of broader plots and themes that are he's working with.
Before I got into the field I'm in professionally, I studied Mandarin in school and actually graduated with a Chinese minor. And Romance of the Three Kingdoms is an absolutely central text to that storytelling tradition. Very similar, I would say, to A Thousand and One Nights or Tale of a Thousand Nights that authors like Saladin Ahmed and Howard Andrew Jones have leaned heavily on. I don't really feel like we've seen nearly enough of Romance of the Three Kingdoms used.
Right, right. And, you know, it's a great story. Yeah, it's their Iliad and Odyssey. It's their Tolkien. It's, you know, it's all that combined. And you know, I assume you've read it. So, you know, it gets a little crazy in places. There's a lot of characters, and this is not like that. It's really defined down to taking some of those characters and boiling them down to much more manageable cast. And but then the races are different, and I mean that as far as ethnicity. Everyone's human, but you know, there's Caucasians and there's Asians and there's, you know, it's all kind of a mix, but it's all secondary world, you know, and so it's you shouldn't rely too heavily, like, you know, this is a Chinese fantasy novel.
Right.
It's not. You know, he's just taking some of those themes in there and playing with them.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll end up being classified as Chinese epic fantasy to some degree. It becomes a marketing pitch at that point, I think. But the truth is, we have a surfeit of cultures portrayed in all kinds of epic fantasies. I've heard Elizabeth Baer and Mazarkas Williams' work dubbed as Silk Road fantasy because of its Asian traditions. But it's not like Robert Jordan's work doesn't also have a ton of that in it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's that. You know, it, I think we just kind of, at least in the West here, we just kind of go, oh, well, you know, yeah, George took, like, War of the Roses to some degree, yeah. And then you just forget about it, and you move on, where there's this overemphasis, and like, okay, what's that aspect here, and what's this culture, and you don't need to know any of this, you know. As his agent and now his editor, the fact that I've read these, like, okay, it's great. We get to talk about it, you know, I get where it's coming from. But he's drilled down a lot deeper than that, and gone further afield.
So is Ken Liu going to be your launch title there in 2015?
No, it's going to come out in April 2015. Okay. Launch title is going to be City of Savages, debut by Lee Kelly. And that one takes place in Manhattan after World War III, where Manhattan, the island of Manhattan, is still a DMZ. And it's two sisters who find their mother's diary from when the war was happening. And they're reading that as they're getting in on the run. It's more like a thriller. It's not post-apocalyptic or anything. It's just near future. But it's fascinating because it's the political aspects of it and the lies and but really what comes out of the characters' voices, and it's really cool. And then Genevieve Valentine's persona, it's it's this acerbic thriller that's kind of like Le Carré meets the craziness of a reality TV gone wild. I love it. And it's this future world where it's kind of like you take the Model UN on steroids, and every country has a face. And it's this beautiful young person, and you're kind of graded on how you look and how you behave and who you're dating, and yet they're also acting as diplomats in a way. And there are these games within games, and it starts off with an assassination attempt, and it just kind of boils out from there, and it's great. And I just love Genevieve's idiosyncratic style of writing. So there's that.
Yeah, she really has a fantastic voice. And you've also bought Stina Light, is that correct?
Yeah, that's going to come out in summer 2015. Okay. That's her epic fantasy series. And that one reminds me of Moorcock and Steven Erickson.
Those are
big names. The Corum books. Which she never read, so but I saw it. so that's great. And then also in the summer, we're going to have Ken Liu's short story collection. So that'll be coming out. And then we also have a military sci-fi series started off for debut with a war on the dark side of the moon, hence the title, The Dark Side War. Zachary Brown, it's another debut. And so it's gonna be fun. It's a fun mix. Going for like commercial and literary, and yet they're all got their little moments of subversiveness, which is what I like.
Well, that sounds just fantastic. You know, I'm particularly pleased to see Stina Light get picked up. You know, she was sort of one of the victims, if you will, of the whole Nightshade fiasco. Her first series that debuted with them back in, I believe, 2011. The first book was Of Blood and Honey, and the second was And Blue Skies of Pain. And, you know, both those novels are just brilliant, and she's a tremendous writer, and I've had a chance to meet her a few times, and she's a tremendous person. So it's got to be exciting to do that, and especially coming out of that Nightshade situation.
It was, especially since they did good work, and Jeremy had has a good eye. Just the business model was not working.
Oh, Joe, you're being so diplomatic. That's that's fine. We don't need to go too deep into this one. I was elbows deep on that particular story last year. I guess was it this time last year when I wrote the article that I wrote on the subject. But yeah, we can go ahead and let you get a jail free card on talking that one.
Yeah, she's a great writer. She's a great writer.
There were certainly lots of great writers, particularly that year with Nightshade. That year where they did all those debuts. I mean, authors like Cameron Hurley, Mazarkus Williams, Courtney Schaefer, Teresa Frohawk, Jonathan Wood. There were just a real cavalcade of authors that came out of Nightshade that year. And so, anyway, it sounds like you guys are really going in a direction that folks should be excited about. I know I certainly am. One of the things I'm most excited about, of course, is that Simon & Schuster is going to make the big five in genre, really the big five. So moving forward, how do you envision Saga's, you know, sort of online presence? Certain publishers do a lot online, obviously. Tor via Tor.com is sort of the bell cow, but Orbit Books has a pretty active site, as do a few of the other publishers, but some of them largely sort of ignore the online space. So I'll be curious to see, where do you see the Saga fit on the online space?
Not to the degree that Tor.com is. I think we're going to utilize Tor.com and IO9 and whatnot. But as far as our own website, yeah, I want to have a voice there. And I want us to have a dialogue with the community. And this is all just really early days. It's been 4 months, but really only a couple of weeks as we're recording this since we announced the press and the imprint, so still early days. But yeah, I'm already thinking, okay, I've got a couple blog posts I got to write up and start posting, and then so I want to have that voice. You know, I like being on Twitter and talking about things and getting the dialogue with the community, because what's so great is that the community is so alive online, fractious as it can be at times. You know, but I think there's a way of using that, and the great websites and podcasts. That's such a vital part of it. You know, it's they move it. You know, and one of the great things about coming from the children's and YA experience is word of mouth really has driven sales. And how does that word of mouth work here? And it's the same way through these websites and podcasts. And so. Definitely want to be a part of that.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. I can't tell you how frustrating it can be when some publishers just don't seem to want to engage very much online. And I'll be interested to get your take on this, because I feel like in the modern day, blogs and podcasts and the online space is really where word of mouth is happening now. You know, in the old days, you used to, you know, court your booksellers, and your booksellers were really driving a lot of the sales and the product. It's not that those folks aren't still doing really important work. They are. But given the amount of volume that's moving online now, you have to think that word of mouth model is really changing to the online space. I'd be interested to get your response to that.
Right. No, I feel it is. You know, not to take away, I'm a foreign bookseller myself. And, but, you know, I think that all generates the same level. And some bloggers and are. And podcasts is our booksellers, our former booksellers. And so I think it's all kind of a great feedback loop that happens there. And I think you take a look at authors that are going on a blog tour, and, you know, it's so much, the bumps don't exist. There used to be the boing boing bump, right? You know, and whatnot, et cetera. You know, and those still happen, but they're much smaller. You know, that's a couple of hundred copies sold when you have somebody get noticed there. But it's the little bit here, there, and then you've got this tremendous voice, and then there's kind of a hype, and then things start moving. And I think that's what you want to build up on. You know, the other word of mouth is really keeping an active voice online, whether it's through promotional prices on ebooks, you know, or, and I'll get into things like that are extended series more than standalones. And, but take a look like at Scott Lynch is more of a recent example, with the third book, Republic of Thieves. You know, on one hand, you go like, well, it's been 5 years since the last book. Meanwhile, it came out and it did better than it ever had. And because you've had these 6-7 years since the last book came out initially, for readership to build. And Scott's a great writer. So, you know, it all comes to this moment here. And I think that's what you have to look at. So it's not one big moment, but a bunch of steps going forward.
Well, it's definitely a challenging discussion. You know, for every Scott Lynch, you've got a dozen folks with trilogies who their first book sells 25, and the next one sells 10, and the next one sells 5. It seems like figuring out how to move those series and books is like a never-ending Rubik's Cube, that the solution is constantly changing.
It is, you know, there are so many titles out there, you know, but I think, again, it's having that dialogue, and if you are consistently having a voice there, then I think you've got a far better chance.
Well, Joe, now you don't just have to worry about selling the manuscript, now you have to worry about selling the book afterward.
Oh, but I love it.
That'll be an exciting new challenge. This has been Rocket Talk with Joe Monty and Justin Landon. Thanks for being here, Joe.
All right. Thanks, Justin.